Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin. This week, the Attorney General of the State of Michigan, Dana Nessel, will be joining us to talk about President Donald Trump's latest suggestion that law enforcement may be needed at polling locations to protect against voter fraud, and among other topics we talked to her about. We also are going to have part one of a pundits panel. The boss, John Rurink, had Steve Mitchell of Mitchell Research and Communications, Ed Zarpolis from Target Insight, and Bernie Porn of Epic MRA in to talk at a special conversation that was held on August 13 with some of our subscribers. We're going to listen to part one of that conversation today. But first, some commentary on some news from Friday that may end up being the burning issue of the short September legislative session that doesn't deal with the budget, and that's the handling of absentee voter ballots. A Republican poll watcher, Bob Cushman, filed an affidavit with the Wayne County Circuit Court that poll workers at the TCF Center in Detroit, where ballots were being counted, were not doing the final checks on AV ballots after 2 a.m. in an effort to get ballots counted quicker and workers out the door faster. This comes after the Detroit News reported that AV ballots in 46% of Detroit's precincts didn't match the ballots cast. The Board of Canvassers met on Monday to address the situation and how to certify the results of Wayne County's election results given this discrepancy. Also, last week, we had a situation in Vernon Township in Shiawassee County where the clerk conceded that she mistakenly sent the wrong absentee ballot to at least one resident who could have ended up voting in a school bonding election for a district he or she didn't live in. There is a complaint that's been filed in that district that even more people received the wrong absentee ballot. We had a problem in Allegan County where a ballot question was mistakenly left off the ballot for voters in Holland, and then those ballots had to be reprinted and a special little election had to be held for about 100 residents in Allegan County. A common theme to all of these issues is the high number of absentee ballots that these clerks are having to deal with, and it's creating strain on the state's election system. The Secretary of State says a record 2.5 million people voted in the August 4 primary and 1.6 million voted absentee. If initial projections are right, and we have more than double that participation in the general, we could have double the problems with the results of key races like president, U.S. Senate, and some congressional districts being put in doubt. That is not the type of attention the state wants. Think 2000. It's been 20 years, and we still remember hanging chads in Florida. These local clerks are not used to handling the type of volume of AV ballots that they're going to be getting. Handling an absentee ballot is not like working the polls either. An ID check is done on site when you're casting a ballot in person. The voter puts his or her ballot into the machine personally. Doing an AV ballot is labor intensive. To properly record, verify signatures, and then count the AV ballots is something that somebody else ends up doing. The voter is not involved in that clerical process, and mistakes are inevitably going to be made when you're talking about decisions and work that is being done after midnight. That's not because these clerks are necessarily incompetent, but when you have overworked people working more hours than they're used to, going late into the morning, mistakes are going to be made. Now, what are the solutions to this? Now, Ruth Johnson, the state senator and former Secretary of State, has talked about allowing election workers to work in shifts. The Secretary of State, Jocelyn Benson, wants to allow clerks to at least be allowed to prepare these AV ballots for counting beforehand. Take a couple days to at least take these ballots out of the envelopes, flatten them out, verify the signatures, and get them ready to throw into the tabulator machine. There's also a training aspect. Are these staffs properly trained? Who's paying for this additional staff who's working in these AV ballot counting boards? All these questions would seem to be out there and need to be answered. I see improving the way that AV ballots are counted as being an issue that needs to be addressed on the policy front in the September session days coming up. Who looks bad if this is not addressed? Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson would obviously be the public face, but will Republican legislative leaders also shoulder some responsibility for knowing that there's going to be a flood of AV ballots cast by people who don't want to show up to the polls out of fear of contracting COVID-19, and then they didn't do anything about it? Well, we're going to find out. Now with that, we're going to bring in the Attorney General, Dana Nessel. Join us now on the podcast is the Attorney General of the State of Michigan, Dana Nessel. Thank you so much for being on the podcast this week.
Thanks for having me, Kyle.
Well, the first thing I wanted to ask about is the Flint water crisis and the settlement that was announced last week. Tell me why it was really important for you and for your office to get some type of resolution on this, as opposed to maybe fighting this out, drawing this out, and maybe getting a lower dollar figure long term for the state.
Well, firstly, I'm not sure that we could have gotten a lower dollar figure for the state. Honestly, I'm not certain, had these cases moved forward, that the state really would have gotten a better deal. So in terms of protecting the state of Michigan, protecting taxpayers, I think that it could have been much worse than it was. But beyond that, you know, and this is something that I said during the announcement of the settlement, I truly believe that the hallmark of good government is not how long and hard one fights against the people of our state, but how long and hard we fight to protect and defend the people of our state. And obviously, I think most people recognize that there were a lot of things that went wrong during the transferring of the water systems over to the Flint River, and that a lot of people suffered as a result of it. And the appropriate thing for the state to do is not to just continue to fight it out in court, but to come to some sort of settlement that actually helps the residents of the city that were harmed. And no one deserves that more, in my opinion, than the children who were drinking water that was potentially very harmful to them. And so I'm very hopeful that this settlement will go a long ways towards helping to heal a city that is still very much in pain and a really harmful and disturbing chapter in our state's history.
A lot of things going on in the news right now. Another suit that you were involved in, or you got the state of Michigan involved in, is the Postmaster General and some of the cost-cutting moves that he had considered. Now, he said last week that he was going to pause any additional cost-cutting measures until after the election. Is the lawsuit then that your office joined in on still necessary due to that announcement?
Well, I think it's absolutely necessary for a number of reasons. Firstly, we have to be certain that when he says that he's not going to continue to implement these measures, he really means it. And, you know, you can't just have somebody swear on their word, on their good word, that they'll do so. You need a court order in place that specifically prohibits any further changes. And in addition, we think it's very important that those changes actually be rescinded. And so that, for instance, if you have these sorting machines in areas like Pontiac or Grand Rapids that are responsible altogether for sorting hundreds and thousands of pieces of mail each and every day, that those are reinstalled. It's very hard for me to understand at any time how it was helpful to make maneuvers like that. But obviously, we are in a situation now, forget all the problems that we know for certain this has caused in terms of people getting their prescriptions on time or paying their utilities on time or even just sending Christmas cards or birthday cards or what have you. Things that we've come to rely on the post office for over 200 years now. But obviously, we are in the midst of a global pandemic. We have a huge election coming up. This is our first presidential election where we have no reason absentee ballot voting in Michigan, and we need to make certain that every eligible voter has the opportunity to exercise their now constitutional right to vote absentee, and that their ballot makes it to their local clerk in time to be counted, which of course we know has to be by 8 p.m. on election day. So at no time is it more important that we have delivery of the mail occurring in an efficient manner. We need to take legal action to ensure that that occurs. We can't just trust that this is going to be the case when we see already what the Postmaster General has done to disrupt mail service.
Well, staying with the whole election theme, Donald Trump said late last week that he's contemplating sending law enforcement officers to polling locations in order to monitor and to prevent voter fraud. I'm reading a quote here from CNN where he's talking about sheriffs sending in law enforcement, U.S. attorneys, maybe even encouraging attorneys generals to go in and do something about this. What's your reaction to that? Are you comfortable sending your folks into the polls?
Well, firstly, I'm absolutely horrified by that statement made by the president. And if President Trump follows through on this threat, it violates numerous sections of federal law. It threatens our free and fair elections. It violates the Constitution, and it actually violates state law. So, you know, the president has no authority over state and local law enforcement officials. That violates the 10th Amendment. Federal law specifically prohibits state and local employees from using their official authority to interfere in a federal election. And federal law specifically prohibits election interference by federal law enforcement or employees or the military. I mean, this kind of activity absolutely constitutes voter intimidation and voter suppression. And so if the president follows through on his promise to send in an army of federal law enforcement to the polls, I absolutely intend to send an army of lawyers into the courts to stop him.
Now, obviously, he's concerned about voter fraud, in particular when it comes to absentee ballots. Have you gotten any word from the Secretary of State's office, any references or any referrals, any type of voter fraud from this past primary election?
Very, very little of that. We did have, you know, and what I will say is this, there are protections that are in place to ensure that there is not voter fraud. So anything that we have seen, we've caught. We had a woman who filled out an application for an absentee ballot for her daughter. We caught her and we prosecuted her. As you know, there were a number of people who voted absentee in the primary who were alive when they voted. They were actual people who were eligible to vote, but unfortunately they passed away between the time that they sent those ballots in and when they were collected and reviewed by their local clerks. So none of them counted, and they were thrown out, which is the proper thing to have happen. So the system is working, and all of these allegations of voter fraud, we know that they're not supported at all. In fact, there was a case that was brought by the GOP against the state of Pennsylvania involving drop boxes. Reported reason alleged that it helped to allow for voter fraud, but then when asked, they could not point to a single instance, not even one instance, of voter fraud where that had actually occurred. So this is fraudulent. And when I say fraudulent, I mean it's fabricated. There is not voter fraud to the extent that it would in any way, shape, or form impede with or create elections that are unreliable. It is merely an effort by the Trump administration to stop people from voting absentee. And what worse time to do so than in the course of a global pandemic? You shouldn't have to risk your life in order to cast a vote.
Now, the president has been to neighboring states recently, Wisconsin, Minnesota. We presume that at some point he's going to come to Michigan. Under what parameters can the president come and have one of his rallies that he's used to having here in the state of Michigan?
Well, I mean, generally speaking, obviously, the governor has implemented a number of executive orders. It has changed from time to time depending on spikes in COVID rates in Michigan. But, you know, there is a limit in terms of the number of people who can congregate in one place. Now, one of the exceptions that the governor has specifically indicated is when it is an exercise of one's First Amendment rights. So, I mean, arguably, even though I think it's a very bad idea from a public health perspective, arguably he could still have one of his rallies because it may fall under, you know, one's First Amendment rights to have, you know, the President of the United States address individuals during the course of his election campaign. But, you know, to me, if this is a president that really cares about the health and safety and welfare of Michigan residents, then he's not going to do something like that. Well, we know when you have large crowds that convene together, especially, of course, if it's done indoors, you're going to see a huge spike in COVID rates. Now, we don't see that as much outdoors, but clearly in terms of the rally that the president had in Tulsa, I mean, we saw a number of COVID cases, and I think arguably that's why Herman Cain is no longer alive today, is because he attended that function. So my great hope is, and I mean, everyone should have the opportunity, obviously, to campaign for their respective offices, but we hope that the president and all other officials will do so in a manner that is safe and that is not going to cause us to have widespread COVID and to have our numbers of deaths and infections go up in our state.
Are law enforcement officers who are not enforcing the governor's executive orders actually breaking state law?
Well, when you say that, are they breaking state law? You know, each elected official has the ability, whether you're a prosecutor, whether you're a local sheriff, you know, you are given wide discretion as to when, how, and where to enforce the law. And as Attorney General, I'll tell you, I've had different priorities than my predecessors have, right? I have enforced many more environmental laws than they ever did. I've enforced payroll fraud cases where they never did before. So, you know, everybody has their priorities in terms of where they want to devote their resources. However, what really bothers me is to have law enforcement not just failing to enforce laws that we know for a fact will save lives if they do so, but then to send the message that these aren't real laws, that they're not enforceable, or that they're unconstitutional. It bothers me to have a local sheriff say, well, I think this law is unconstitutional, when we know that both the state courts and the federal courts have upheld these executive orders. And what's interesting to me, of course, is that these were Republican panels, both at the Sixth Circuit and then also in the Court of Appeals in Michigan, that upheld the governor's executive orders as they pertain to all these COVID-related measures. And so then to have a sheriff who, you know, is not a lawyer, go out and say, well, I don't think this is enforceable, when the courts very specifically have evaluated this and said they are, I think they're doing a great disservice to the constituents that they serve. And I think that people die as a result of it. And I find that very unfortunate. Now, at the end of the day, it will be the voters of those municipalities or those counties that ultimately will hold those electeds accountable, and they'll have the opportunity later to say, I think my sheriff did a good job of protecting me, or I think my sheriff committed malfeasance by not protecting me. But it is, honestly, that is their decision to make as an elected official, whether I agree with that or not.
Last question I wanted to ask you, is the legal remedies to try and shut down Line 5 or stop this tunnel from being built, are they running out?
Oh, no, I wouldn't say so at all. Okay. In fact, you know, Judge Jamo in the Ingham County Circuit Court is still evaluating our efforts to decommission Line 5. And, you know, we're hopeful that sooner rather than later, Judge Jamo will have made a decision. I think he's been very thoughtful so far in terms of evaluating the facts and the law of that case. And then, as we know, the Michigan Public Service Commission now is evaluating the matter of whether they'll grant the easement for the tunnel. And, you know, there are a lot of factors to consider. There's a lot of parties that have moved to intervene in that case, including my department. And honestly, the Enbridge is going to have to prove that this is not going to be a project that is ecologically damaging to our natural resources. And they're also going to have to prove that it's necessary that they have this tunnel, and that there's no easier way that's less damaging to the state to provide the fuel that would be running through the tunnel. So obviously we have a lot of options that are still available and a lot of things for the commission as well as the courts to evaluate. And, you know, I look forward to decisions being made on in both of those arenas.
All right. Attorney General Dana Nessel, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, the following is part one of a two-part series that we're going to do with our conversation with three prominent pollsters in the state of Michigan, Ed Zarpolis, Steve Mitchell, and Bernie Porn.
We're glad to have some of the state's leading pollsters on the line with us, Steve Mitchell from Mitchell Research, Ed Zarpolis from Target Insight, Bernie Porn from Epic MRA is with us. Many of you probably don't realize this, but Bernie and Ed and I go back all the way to the mid-80s when Bernie and Ed were working polls for the Democrats in the House. I was a page back then, so we go way, way back. So I'm going to start with a couple of basics, because one of the things I wanted this webinar to be was sort of about sort of the mechanics of polling. So I'm going to start, Steve, with you. I want to talk specifically about the 2016 label that pollsters got of being inaccurate. There was a lot of assertions that polls were no longer effective because not enough of them had Trump within striking distance. They had Hillary Clinton way out front for so long. Are those assertions inaccurate, or were the polls in 2016 inaccurate?
The assertions are inaccurate. If you take a look at the Real Clear Politics average of polls, their final average showed that Hillary Clinton was leading by 3.2%. In fact, she won by 2.1%. So the polls nationally were off by only 1%, and that is very, very accurate polling. And when you take a look down the list of the polls, they were all in that margin, and the closer it got to Election Day, the closer it got. So absolutely, at one point, Hillary Clinton had a huge lead. I looked at the polls back in late July, and at that point, nationally, Biden had a lead of about 10 or 12 points. And then I looked back to the four or five polls around that same time on the Real Clear Politics average, and what I discovered was, in fact, Hillary Clinton had a 14.5% lead at that same time. So races tend to tighten up, and they do here in Michigan. If you take a look at what the numbers were 4 years ago in Trump versus Clinton, the average was Clinton plus 3.6. In fact, the final margin was obviously 0.3. But Ed Zarpolis had a poll out the night of the election showing it a very, very close race. So did John Yap. So the idea that the polls were wrong is wrong.
Bernie, when you start look at the presidential races in polling, what always strikes you that maybe people don't understand about polling when they're sort of doing the horse race when it comes to presidential politics?
Especially now, you need to have an adequate representation of cell phone calls. We used to have 20% cell phones, and now we're at least 40% on our statewide polls. And a lot of national pollsters will use 50% or more. I know that Stan Greenberg is using that amount. And that's important to have enough cell phones in the sample.
Ed, you know, when we talk about polling, I always hear pollsters talk about weighting. Describe how you weight a poll and what goes into factoring how you weight a poll, like, for example, in today's climate.
Well, in today's climate, you have to understand where the vote is coming from. Okay? And I don't mean that we're going to predict what we think is going to happen on Election Day, but what do voters tell us? For example, like, it's all about based on turnout. If, you know, maybe people use the census data to predict how they're going to weight the survey. Well, if you use the census data, you're going to overweight one area of the state. But in turnout, they may be half of what their population is. And so in the African American community, they make up 16% of the state. But in a vote, and they may make up an election day only 9%. So you have to decide what is their turnout number, not their what the census data says. Then you have to look at age. And people says, well, what do you do? A lot of times when you do polling, whether you use cell phones or not, depends on what time you call or during the week, you might have an oversampling of people over 60 years of age. So you're going to have to reweight the data and get down to a much younger population. And the same thing when you look at gender. If you're polling Democrats, the female base may get up to 58% of the vote. And Republican, I know Steve does the same thing, it could be 50-50 or slight advantage male voters. You know, weighting is based on what the population does, not what we say it is according to the census.
But let's say you were weighting today a poll you just took this week. What would you look at to help you decide how to weight participation? I mean, is it other polls? Is it the news? Is it what goes into that thinking?
Well, first of all, when you look at the data, first of all, I'm going to stratify the state, okay? Break it up into regions so I know exactly what their contribution is. The second I'm going to look at the final thing is that, and Bernie, Steve, and I've all talked about before, is what's the party base in the poll? We have to, so basically when the poll is completed, do I have too many Democrats, too many Republicans, not enough people? Many times, a lot of people won't say what party they are. So I'm going to have to build in questions of the survey. The people that are Republican, are they hiding in the poll? And are they really showing up? So I'm going to wait based on party. So I may go back to past elections. You know, one thing that we've learned over the years, the fact is that people don't always say what party they are. And so if you go back to the 90 election, Bill Clinton, the independent vote's truly about 19%. Democrats come up around 42 and Republicans around 39. And so you've got that margin you can go into. So you're going to have to say, you have to go back to the State Board of Red Race. State Board of Education is where the Secretary of State tells you all the people that bomb the ticket that typically vote straight party, who they're voting for a State Board of Education. And so if you go back to past elections, you can see the fact, well, if the poll is saying that the Democrats are 70% of the poll, you know you're way off. Because in past elections, generally, there's a Democrat-Republican split no more than 6%. When John Engler won back in the days when people thought he was going to lose, the partisan base was almost tied, 42-43 apiece.
Anybody else want to add on that waiting discussion?
Well, there's one thing that we get asked a lot by the national media in terms of whether or not they're going to cover our polls, and that is whether or not there's waiting on education. As a matter of fact, Stan Greenberg had said that after 2016, he was going to make sure that around 60% were non-college educated voters, because the word was that the pollsters were not adequately representing the non-college educated white voters, white men especially, in the 2016 election. And we quite naturally have around 42-45% college educated or post-college educated voters in our sample. And you'll have the 57-60% non-college. And that's something that every single national media outlet was asking about, as to whether or not we waited by that. And we told them, well, we have naturally come up with the range where it should be. And so we haven't had to wait based on education.
Okay. Bernie, that goes back to the fact that a lot of three of us, we understand when we wait to poll, we're not waiting on census, we're waiting on actual turnout areas. So we actually pick up those educated people, because we're not oversampling a partition of state, even though they've got a lot of people, they're not oversampling our part of a survey. So we reach out to Oakland and Ann Arbor that many other people would not.
There's one other thing to add, and that is that some people who do reweighting, I have seen some pollsters, and I'm not talking about either Steve or Ed, but some pollsters in the business will take like a small number of African Americans and reweight it to represent like a couple hundred, you know, the 20 or 30, and then make it 200. I am of the belief that you should never reweight a demographic group more than to the extent of like 10 to at the most 20%. When you have someone that's tripling the size of a weighted demographic group, you're just manufacturing data.
Good morning, guys, and very excited to have you all here. Steve, I'll start with you on this particular question. How do you determine the universe of people that you believe is going to vote in the election? Obviously, we can look at the 2016 data and see who showed up, but that doesn't mean that that's going to be the people who show up in 2020. How do you figure out what goes into the calculus of who is actually going to show up in 2020?
There's a couple of ways you can do that. You can take a look at past voter participation and use lists, for instance, that have voters that traditionally show in all elections. In 2016, and I will do it again in 2020, I essentially take registered voters. I want to cast as wide a net as I possibly can, and then use filter questions to make sure they're going to vote in the election. So I'll take all registered voters. We'll ask them, you know, are you a registered voter? If they say yes, we continue. If they say no, we don't. But then I'll ask them, thinking about the upcoming election, are you definitely voting, probably voting, not sure yet, or definitely not voting? Early on, I'll get rid of all those who say they're definitely not voting. As we get closer, I'll get rid of those who say even that they're not sure yet, because if you're into late October and you're not sure you're going to vote, chances are you're not. So I like to cast in a presidential election as wide a net as possible, so I'm not missing people who have not voted in the past, but who will be voting in a presidential race, because a presidential race brings out the largest possible universe. And it's never other issues on the ballot in a presidential race. It's the race for the presidency that brings people out. So in that way I do. And you get into primary races, that's a different matter. Then you take a look at those with a record of voting in, say, three of the last five primaries, and you use that as your universe. Filter out to make sure that you're, and questions like that. If I'm doing a primary race for a Republican candidate for office, I'll ask him, are you a registered voter? Are you going to be voting in the primary election? Again, they have to say definitely, probably, or not sure yet. If the voting has already continued, then we ask them, have you already voted? In which case, then we continue to take their answers, but that way we know how those who have already voted do. And then in a primary, we'll say, thinking in a primary election, you cannot split your ticket as you do in a general election. In this primary, will you be voting for the Republican, the Democrat, or you're not sure? And if they say not sure or Democrat, we get rid of them. So now we know that we're polling only those voters who are Republican Party primary voters. And that's how you get an accurate reading of primary elections.
We have one question from our audience. How do you determine margin of error? So talk a little bit about margin of error.
I have a little cheat sheet that shows the size, and you can plug it into any number of different programs that will tell you, based on the number of interviews you have, what the margin of error would be. Our surveys are plus or minus 4% for a 600 sample. Usually when you have a 500 sample, it'll be 4.4. A 400 sample will be 4.9. 300 would be 5.7. Get into the 1,000 or more, well, that's where you have in the 2 to 3% margin of error range.
Is there a limit, guys? I wanted to follow up on that. Is there a limit to which is a good sample size? I mean, is there a point where you can pull too much and there's diminishing returns as far as what your client is paying for?
Well, basically it comes down, this is answer poll. The question there is, what are you looking for? All of us are doing a statewide poll. For example, when you're doing message testing for a candidate, okay, you may find out this one message moves a certain population of people. Well, you may be oversampling that person because you need to find out who they are, what their demographic is. Because remember, when you do a survey, if you got 1,000 people and the people that you're moving only make up 50 of those samples, you've got to oversample those people. So there's never too many. As the question of fact is, what do you need to get the answers that you need to be sure that you're making the right decision based on the data?
Is 1,000 kind of the cap? I mean, after you get past 1,000, you're kind of wasting your money at that point?
No, we've had clients, and Bernie and I, when we're working together, and I still have clients even today, I have to do 2,500 in Michigan. Because what they're looking for, the demographics, is regional breakouts, the demographics by Asians. And I've done a couple of polls amongst Muslims in Michigan. I have to oversample a lot. I have to have a large sample to pull out those Muslims and their religion to identify how those people of Middle Eastern descent are doing. So there's never a large enough sample. I mean, the Census Bureau does a minimum of 2,500 in the state all the time. And I've done polls that we did a gaming study over years ago. We had about 5,000 people we did in the state. It depends on what the needs are of the client.
On the same topic of sort of breakouts, we've talked about a lot at MERS. What is a large enough breakout as far as a demographic from a poll, a crosstab, that it should be written about? We've had some journalists want to write about a very small, they want to analyze the crosstabs to such a small degree, we wonder whether it's even worth writing about. If you were to advise your journalism customers, for example, Bernie, what size sample should you use if you're going to get into detailed cross-tab analysis?
If it is below 50 respondents, it should not be used unless, and this is an important caveat, unless that group is fairly consistent with other groups that are larger. Now, sometimes you will use those numbers and say, well, that's consistent with this and this. But if it stands out and it's below 50 and it's really out of whack with what other demographic groups look at the same question, well, then I would say definitely do not use it. And I have talked to reporters who have made a story out of it and headlines about a result. And I said, well, you know, you use that based on 25 people. You do not want to do that.
I heard a long time ago 38 is statistically valid subsample, but I generally do the same thing. I think 50 is probably the smallest subsample you should look at in a survey.
How do you accommodate the fact that so many of us now are just carrying around this pocket phone and don't have landlines anymore?
As Bernie said earlier, you'd like to get 40% at least now in terms of cell phones, if you can do it. The cost of cell phones is at least twice as expensive as landlines. So it really becomes a cost issue. But you have to try to have at least a third of cell phones, especially as you're going after younger voters under the age of 45. Older voters, there is a difference in how they vote from landlines to cell phones. But my sense is, if at all possible, you want to use as many cell phones as you can get, whether it's 25, 33, 40% or half.
Just to let people know the fact, I did a lot of polling in North and South Carolina this year for some clients. And believe it or not, there is in the country that don't have a lot of cell phones. It's actually 70% landline. I did the house district primaries up in the UP. It's landline because their cell phones don't work. So yes, there are cell phones we have to take into account, but you also have to understand the area that you're polling in. Because if you think that you're, and the other thing when you use cell phones, you have to do more certainly that person is actually living at the address in the district in the zip code that you're actually calling. Because people can take their New York number to downtown Detroit. You got to be sure that you understand who you're calling and that number relates to where they're living. Landlines are much more specific, but for cell phones, they could be anywhere when you call them, unless you got a current list of cell phone numbers.
We have a question from the audience. How will mail-in voting change your turnout model? Anybody want to tackle that?
Going back again to that question of, I'm going to cast a wide net. One of the questions we ask as soon as absentee ballots or mail-in ballots go out is, thinking about the upcoming election, have you already voted? Are you definitely voting, probably voting, or not sure yet? And then you can track that. We did that very successfully. I did a lot of polling in legislative districts and congressional districts in the last, in this primary that just was held on August 3rd. And that question was showing us that we had races tightening at the end, but we already had enough votes in the bank, had already been cast, that we knew our clients were in really strong shape. And I think in one race where it tightened up by election day, the margin was down to about 6%. Candidate won in by double digits. We knew that the candidate was in good shape because we were tracking how they had already voted. So I don't think it changes the models at all, except that you're gonna have more people voting by mail. So you have to start asking that question earlier on.
As a matter of fact, I was tracking the Rashida Brendan Jones race, and I had it by 4 weeks out that actually I was already at 32% Brendan. She never moved because I asked the same question. Have you already voted to do that? And I saw 60% of the people already had voted absentee. I checked with the city clerk. He already said that. So I pretty much knew that, in fact, there was going to be very little movement for Brendan Jones in the last 3 weeks of the campaign, basically doing what you said, screening for that question.
Earlier this year, we had the opportunity. We were somebody from New York, a firm from New York, reached out to me and asked about if we would be interested in some internet-based polling results on the COVID-19. And we did run some for a little while. Is it talk about internet, purely internet-based polling? Is that the future? Is it accurate? Cautions? What do you guys think?
Problem with self-selection. You're not reaching out and getting your sample. You're laying out the possibility of participation, and there's no control over that. And you can re-weight after you get the participation, but it's most useful on the internet surveys for like parents of school-age children for school districts and homogeneous groups. Unless you have a base of emails and information that allows you to have a weighted sample of who you're reaching out to, and then you can check after you get the data back.
We have another interesting audience question from one Ed Rivet. Do the pollsters think the media generally create headlines and story narratives that match the polling data accurately, or is there some spinning on the part of the media?
Your question was, will the news media take a poll and pull out the parts of the poll to cover that is more in line with the editorial viewpoint of that particular paper? Is that your question?
Right. All right. How accurately are your polls portrayed?
They have to portray accurately what the head-to-head totals are. But again, I think, unfortunately, we live in a world where the news media has become bifurcated. You have strong conservative Republican news outlets. You have strong liberal Democratic news outlets. And I think that yes, there is unfortunately partisanship that creeps into how they portray a poll or how much coverage. Is that poll going to be on the front page? Is it going to be the top story on the internet? Or if the numbers aren't so good for the candidate that they may prefer, is that going to get buried into the second section? Is it going to be on the fifth story down so that not as many people see it?
And Steve and Bernie, we all done this. I've actually had to go back on the media saying the report on the poll was wrong. That's the wrong interpretation. One thing in our business that we're still doing this, even though I look kind of old, because of the fact we have a reputation of challenging the accuracy of our coverage of the polls. Okay, for example, I've been in court 3 times on my polling, and as an expert witness, he says, well, your poll said the candidate was going to win. I said, no, it didn't. It said they were leading. Okay, during the whole campaign, Hillary Clinton over in Michigan, Hillary was never over 50%. She was always under 50%. She was leading but not winning. So that's where the interpretation comes in. In fact, when you look at data, leading and winning is two different things. Secondly, when it comes to the national polls, if you go back over the last 60 or 70 years, Democrats tend not to win the Electoral College unless they're leading the Republican by 4 or 5 points come election day. So when you see a popular vote win of 2.5%, 3%, it doesn't mean Republican is going to lead because he's only leading in the popular vote. Nationally, polls have to lead by 4 or 5% for the Democrats to win the Electoral College. That's very understanding historical perspective of a poll.
And that's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Attorney General Dana Nessel for joining us. And also the boss, John Roering, for holding this pollster summit that has some very interesting conversation. You'll want to tune in next week to hear part two, where we get into more political prognostications as opposed to this week, which is kind of more the nuts and bolts of polling and some of the issues that you're seeing in the polling industry. Until then, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care. We'll be right back.